Anyone that believes in the power of ideas and the power of ideas to change history has to be fascinated by monotheism. Here's one idea that dramatically and radically changed the course of history. Now, it's a very effective idea, but it's also a very misunderstood idea. What is monotheism? Now, in my reading, I want to follow the guidance of probably one of the most important scholars that researched the idea of monotheism in the Bible. I'm talking about Yechezkel Koifman. Here's how Yechezkel Koifman, he was a student of the great philosopher Hermann Cohen, and these ideas are very Hermann Cohen ideas, but he reads them into the Bible and uses them to explore the hidden philosophy of the Bible. So what is monotheism? If you ask anyone in a school system, what is monotheism? It'll be opposed to polytheism. Pagans believe there are many gods. Monotheists believe there's only one God. Meaning monotheism is like this mathematical move where we shrunk from many gods to one God. Koifman argues that's a very shallow understanding and probably a wrong understanding of monotheism. Monotheism is not just about playing with the numbers from many to one. It's a deeper move. To understand the deeper move of monotheism, we have to understand the depth, and there is depth, in the whole pagan theology. The pagan theology assumes that the world, there's a lot of energy in nature. Nature is much more than we can see or you can even imagine. There's mysterious forces in nature. And the gods are a part of nature. Now, since the gods are part of the natural system, so the gods are limited because the great laws of nature and the principles of nature, well, the gods are those principles are imposed on the gods too. So what really exists is the nature and the cosmic laws of nature, and the gods are part of nature. Some people see it this way: the gods are the personalization of the powers of nature. There's the God of the ground, of earth, and the God of the sky, and the God of the ocean, and God of the wind, and God of the sun. The gods are the inner life of nature. What is monotheism? Monotheism is not that there is not many gods but one God, because there's different forms of paganism that believe that there's one God. Let's say there's only one God and it's the sun. That's still paganism. That's not monotheism, even though they got the numbers right. One God. What is monotheism? It's not, there's a pun in Hebrew, I'll say it in Hebrew and explain it in English. Zelo la'amin sha'el hu echad ela shehu meyuchad. This pun doesn't work in English, but I'll say it anyway. It's not to believe that God is one, it's to believe that God is radically different, radically other. Here's the move of monotheism. If pagans believe that the gods are a part of this world, monotheism is separating God from world. God is beyond this world. The important theological move here is creation. Because God created the world, therefore God is different from the world. God is not world. Separation of God from world is the important move of monotheism. Which means monotheism is not a faith, it's a heresy. It's a disbelief. It's people in the ancient world that stop believing in nature. It's heresy. Suddenly the ocean is just the ocean. The forest is just a forest. The sky is just a sky. Monotheism, in a deep sense, is the sacralization of nature, emptying nature from God. Nature is empty. Now, once nature is empty, some anthropologists and historians of ideas say that monotheism paved the way for modern science. Because once nature is empty, once nature is not spooky, that's not filled with gods, we could observe nature rationally, analyze nature rationally, what paves the way for modern science. And the first move is monotheism, separating God from nature, emptying nature from gods. Therefore, monotheism is a revolution. It introduces an important secular component into our religious worldview. That is the background which I would like to use, the theological background I would like to use to understand understand some verses in the book of Deuteronomy. For Deuteronomy, the greatest sin is idol worshiping. And it's trying to create a monotheistic society. Society where God is not, God is there. He's above, he's other, he's different, he's the mystery, but he's not here. And he's definitely not something that we can control. So I would like to start with Deuteronomy chapter 8. Deuteronomy chapter 8, I'll start with verse 14, to describe the connection between an interesting psychology and theology. So we start with verse 14. It says, "One day you'll enter the land of Israel," Moshe says. "You'll conquer the land, you'll become wealthy and extremely successful, and then something bad will happen to you. V'ram levavcha, v'shachachta et Adonai Elohecha. And your heart will be lifted," which is the Hebrew way to describe the sin of hubris, where your understanding of yourself changes. This is what happens sometimes to successful people. You have success, and success changes you. It changes the way you understand yourself. Hubris is a false interpretation of what happened to you. It's when success happens to you, and you think, it's not something that happened to me, it's something that I am. I am a successful person. By the way, people become depressed from failure for the same reason. They don't say, oh, I failed. They think they are failures. When you identify with something that happens to you, it could lead either to depression or to hubris. V'ram levavcha v'shachachta Hashem Elohecha. This is when success turns into hubris. When you think you're much more than what you really are because of success that you're enjoying. And what does that lead? I'm skipping to verse 19. When you v'ram levavcha v'shachachta et Adonai Elohecha, when you forget God because your heart is lifted. Verse 19. V'hayayim shachoch tishkach et Adonai Elohecha, when you forget God. V'halachta acharei Elohim acharim v'avadetam v'ishtachavita lahem. When you forget God, you will worship other gods. This is an idea that appears three times in the book of Deuteronomy. Success leads to forgetting God, which leads to worshiping other gods. Now, this doesn't make any sense. I understand why pride will lead to forgetting God. Because you think you're in the center of the cosmos, you want nothing above you or beyond you. You don't submit to a higher authority. You feel like you are the high authority. So I understand why hubris could lead to forgetting God. But how does hubris lead to worshiping foreign gods? If you are thinking so highly of yourself, you're not worshiping one God, why worship many gods? Why is it that there's such a strong linkage between pride and idol worshiping? How, in what sense, is idol worshiping an expression of pride, arrogance, and hubris? And now, this connection between idol worshiping and arrogance, which is very clear in the book of Deuteronomy, is even more clear in the prophets. This is an idea that I'm trying to share, a textual idea that I'm trying to share throughout this course, throughout these lectures, is that the prophets are the best interpreters of the Torah, of the book of Deuteronomy. And we can find this, for example, the connection between pride and idol worshiping. The prophet Ezekiel, in chapter 28, he has a prophecy of the king of Tzor. The king of Tzor. And he says, Emor l'negid Tzor, ko amar Adonai, ya'an gava libcha, your heart was lifted. The king of Tzor is suffering from hubris. Vatomar el ani, I am God. Moshav Elohim yeshavti, belev yamim. So I am God, I am sitting on the throne of God. That is the self-awareness of the leader of Tzor. Later on, Ezekiel, in a different chapter, this is how he will describe the leader of Egypt, Pharaoh. Ko amar Adonai, hineni alecha paro, Pharaoh, melech Mitzrayim, hatanim hagadol harovetz betoch yeorav, Pharaoh is the mythological monster that is sitting in the Nile, and this is what he's saying, Asher amar li yeori ve'ani asitini. I am the Nile. I created the world. I am the creator. This is the omnipotent awareness of Pharaoh, according to Ezekiel. In a different place, in a different chapter, Isaiah, this is how he imagines the self-awareness of the king of Assyria, of Ashur. Ve'ata amarta bilvavecha, he's saying that the king of Assyria is saying to himself, Hashamayim e'ele, I'll go up to the sky. Mima'al lekochavei el, above the stars of God. Arim kisi ve'eshev behar moed bi'arketei tzafon. That the king of Assyria feels like he's literally in the sky, literally a star, literally sitting among the stars. So the prophets are aware that that part of paganism is like a sense of self-worship, self-importance. And again, I want to ask the question, what's the connection between idol worshiping and a sense of self-importance, self-worship, self-deification? What's the connection here? To understand this, it's a connection that the Bible presents but doesn't explain. But modern anthropologists could help us understand this. And I want to use here the work, the important work of the great anthropologist James Frazer, that unrevealed the connection between, he didn't put it this way, but I think he does unreveal the connection between arrogance and paganism. And for that, we have to understand the very important component of paganism. And this is magic. So we'll do now, I want to use the work of the way anthropologists understood magic in order to understand how the prophets understood paganism. So how do modern anthropologists understand magic? Magic is a major part of all ancient pagan religions. What is magic? Magic is a belief that in the cosmos and nature, there are centers of energy. And with the right rituals, with the right moves, we could tap into those centers of energy and channel those energies and use that energy in our service. I'll give you an example. This is what Frazer calls sympathetic magic. Let's say Mars has energy. By the way, many people know what energy we have in Mars. It's the energy of war, energy of violence, energy of destruction. And let's say I know how to capture the energy of Mars. How do I do that? There is an esomorphic logic here of the magical world. If I could create an icon, which is the perfect icon of Mars, that icon would somehow magnetize to it the energy of Mars. And when I do that, now I have the energy of Mars for my usage, for my disposal. I can manipulate it now. But not many people know exactly how you do the icon of Mars. But if the magicians that know how to do the icon of Mars can somehow magnetize the power of Mars to that icon. This is something that to understand this, we have to understand that according to magicians, according to the pagan world, this is how most people used to think. The relationship between a symbol and what it symbolizes is inherent. It's substantial. In some way, when you have a perfect symbol of something, it captures the presence of that something. That is why magicians that know how to do a voodoo doll of someone, if they stab the doll, that someone will feel pain. Why? Because they believe that the energy, the presence of that someone is present in the doll that represents him. By the way, English carries that magical idea. To represent in some way, you make it present. The presence, some of its energy is present in the symbol. So if I make a symbol of Mars, I could somehow magnetize the energy of Mars to that symbol. So there's different techniques of magic. But what magic has in power is that, what magic has in common is that magic is about power. Magic is about control. It's rituals that give us power to control our surroundings, to control nature, to control other people. That is what magic is about. As Professor Shulman, David Shulman from Hebrew University, that investigates ancient Indian rituals, it says if you do like a ritual that's supposed it's supposed to bring rain. You perform the ritual, there's a dance you have to do. You perform the ritual, it will rain. Now what if you perform the ritual and it doesn't rain? What does that mean? All it means is you didn't do it right. Rituals work. Magic is about power. There's a lot of details. You have to do it the right way, and then it works. And if it didn't rain, or you didn't win the war, or she didn't fall in love with you, or something you wanted to happen didn't happen, it's just because you did not perform the ritual right. Rituals are about power, and practicing rituals is a practice of control. Monotheism, in a deep sense, is a destruction of magic. Why is monotheism a destruction of magic? Because if this world, if nature is now empty from gods, if God, which controls everything, is beyond this world, so God, that is in control of everything, is beyond our realm of control. So one of the dramatic implications of monotheism, separating God from world, suddenly all our rituals are empty. We press the buttons and nothing happens because God is beyond nature and therefore beyond our control. That's why a new belief, monotheism, transforms rituals, transforms religion. It's not about control anymore. So what is it about? The new idea that the Bible introduces and that the Talmud expands is the idea of prayer. Now, prayer is not an act of control. It's actually an expression of no control, of having no control. You ask God, but you're not pressing a button. It's not about controlling. It's about realizing that you're not in control. You're just asking. There's a famous, famous story that many Israelis know. This is a true story. When Nachshon Waksman, an Israeli soldier, was kidnapped by Hamas, so his parents asked the entire Jewish world to pray for Nachshon's safety. And Esther Waksman asked all the women in the Jewish world to light candles that Shabbat. And so many of them did. And they asked Israelis to go to the Kotel that evening and pray and say psalms. And so many of them did. I was one of them. And I remember that Friday night in the Kotel, many people said, this has to work. So much good energy, so many prayers, the Jewish people saying psalms, this will work. Well, we didn't know that while we were in the Kotel, there was a heroic attempt by our soldiers, by the soldiers of Israel, to release Nachshon Waksman. It failed. Nachshon died, and another hero, Nir Poraz, was killed too. Yehuda Waksman was asked by a very not polite Israeli reporter the theological question. He said, so God didn't answer your prayers. And his answer was so deep theologically. He said, he did answer our prayers. Abba Amar Lo. God, or our Father, said no. That is the deep, what his answer is the exact distinction between magic and prayer. If you think that everybody does it together and therefore it has to work, there's a button that if we just know how to press it, we'll have control. Yes, it's magic. The revolution of monotheism gave birth to prayer. It's something you do and you cannot control the results. A new idea of God creates a different idea of religion. Let's think about the world of magic again. If magic is that I perform a ritual and the world changes. So who's in control in the pagan world? The people who perform the ritual. So who's actually God in this world? Who's omnipotent? Who has the power? the people that know the secrets to magic, the people that know how to control the system, the people, those are the people that have the power. Maybe this is the connection between hubris and paganism. When people have success, let's say success economically, they have control. Success politically, success militarily, the seduction of paganism is great because now maybe you can control nature, you can control the gods, you can control everything. An interesting moment in the book of Deuteronomy is when the book tries to remember again what really happened on Mount Sinai. And this is something that we mentioned in one of our past lectures, but there's so much there to cover. What really happened on Sinai? So in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 9, he says, Rak yishamer lecha ushmor nafshecha pen tishkach et advarim asher ra'u einecha ופן יסור מלבבך כל ימי חייך וודעתם לבניך ולבני בניך יום אשר עמדת לפני השם אלוהיך בחורב. Never forget what happened on Sinai. Sinai is also called Chorev. Never forget that day. But the emphasis is, never forget what your eyes saw that day. Never forget what you saw. And then, five verses later, he tells us what we saw. What is that thing that we should never, ever forget? And this is what he says. V'nishmartem me'od nafshotechem, ki lo ra'item kol tmuna, v'yom diber Adonai Elohechem b'chorev mitoch ha'esh. Let's put this together. Never forget what you saw. And then he says, but what did you see? Never forget that you didn't see anything. Ki lo ra'item kol tmuna b'yom diber Hashem Elohechem mitoch ha'esh. Never forget what you saw. Never forget that you didn't see anything in Sinai. This is the paradox of Revelation. What was revealed in Sinai is that nothing was revealed. There was all the background music for Revelation. There was the shofarot, the dramatic cosmic shofar blowing. There was fire. There was all the pyrotechnics, all the background music for the appearance of the king, just without the appearance of the king. The drama in Sinai, according to Deuteronomy, is not that there was a revelation, is that there wasn't a revelation. It's that we saw that we didn't see. That's the paradox of Revelation on Sinai, that we saw in our eyes that we didn't see anything. And now that is the explanation why we can't do any idol for God. We can't create an icon for God. There's nothing. God is so transcendent, so beyond, we cannot represent Him. And we go back to the logic of magic. If we cannot represent God, we can't make Him present. We can't use His presence, use His energy, use His spirit to gain power, to gain control. Monotheism creates a religion that's not about power and not about controlling. Actually, what are the Ten Commandments are about? Well, the first three commandments look like this. Commandment number one, Anochi Hashem Elohecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Yitzrayim Mibet Avadim. The first commandment is an introduction. I am the Lord your God. And the drama that just happened to you, you were just liberated from Egypt, that was me. I liberated you from Egypt. You might think it was Moses. No, it was me. That's the introduction. Something big happened to you, and it was me. It was God. God liberated you from Egypt. That's commandment number one. God liberated us. Therefore, we have to be completely loyal to Him, so we can't worship any other gods. Second commandment, we cannot represent God. Now, when you add these two commandments together, it means you can only worship God, and the only God you can worship, you're limited in the way you can worship Him. You cannot represent Him. You cannot make Him alive. You cannot feel His presence. You cannot somehow magnetize His energy. Monotheism is the attempt to live in the presence of a God that's not really present. to live aware of a God that's not there, that's radically beyond nature and radically beyond the realm that you control. If paganism is about religion is the way we have a sense of control, monotheism is recognizing that we have no control. Which takes me to a conclusion of this lecture. Spinoza, in his introduction to the Theological Political Treatise, tries to understand why are rituals born? Why are irrational rituals born? Why is religion such a universal phenomenon? And he says it's because people are anxious, because people are afraid. This is what Spinoza says, or this is how I understand Spinoza. That when we're thinking of the future, we're always somehow wandering between hope and anxiety. And our mind lives in the future. That's why we're constantly anxious. Because one of the differences between human beings and animals is that animals, at least that's how they always used to understand them, their mind is in their present, their mind is where they are. But human beings, their mind is mostly in the future. We live in the future. That's one thing we know. We know there is a future, and there's a second thing we know. We know we can't control the future. And the combination of those understandings creates constant existential anxiety, because we all know that anything could happen. How do you deal with that anxiety? Spinoza says that's why religion was born, to give you an illusion of control. I think what Spinoza didn't understand is the distinction between magic and prayer, paganism and monotheism. That the pagan religion was about giving you tools to deal with anxiety, was about delivering you through rituals a sense or maybe an illusion of control. Monotheism, I'm not saying this is the daily monotheism. I'm not saying this is how most religious Jews behave, think, and believe. I'm saying monotheism, it's at its best day. Monotheism the way Moshe wanted it. Monotheism the way Maimonides understands it is the other way around. It's not about practicing control. It's about accepting the fact that we have no control. And this is why there's a strong connection between psychology and theology. Monotheism is an expression of humility. Paganism is an expression of hubris. And this is why success that leads to hubris could also lead to idolatry. Monotheism is protected by a strong sense of humility, and it sustains a strong sense of humility. And because religion either could be about power and control or about training your mind to understand that you have no control, for that reason, monotheism has also a lot to say about politics. And politics is what we're going to try to talk about in our next lecture. Thank you very much. So let's put it together. What guarantees that the king will stay in power, that he'll give up his power? This is the paradox of political power in the heart of the book of Deuteronomy.